Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Wall of Power, a radio hour. This is your host, Paul Metza. I couldn't be more excited to have my guest on tonight. She is one of my favorite journalists, radio hosts, and cool gals in all of Minnesota. Miss Andrea Swenson is an author, podcast host, and music journalist in Minneapolis. She hosts the official Prince podcast and has written for numerous publications, including NPR Music, Pitchfork, the Star Tribune, City Pages, and Minnesota Public Radio's The Current, where she previously hosted the local show for years and years. Her first book, Got to Be Something Here, The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound, also from the University of Minnesota Press, like the book we'll be talking about tonight, won a 2018 Minnesota Book Award. The book we're going to be talking about tonight is Deeper Blues, The Life, Songs, and Salvation of Cornbread Harris by Miss Andrea Swenson. We're going to talk all about cornbread and listen to some music as the show goes on. But first of all, good evening, Miss Swenson. How are you doing?
I am doing wonderful, especially after that warm introduction. My goodness.
Well, I've been a big fan of yours for years, and we've got to know each other over the years. And you were kind enough to moderate when my book, Alphabet Jazz, Poetry, Prose, Stories, and Songs, came out, and we had a big show at the Women's Club. You were kind enough to moderate that, and I couldn't have been more honored. And what's fun about this book, number one, it just came in the mail. The timing couldn't be more perfect. We were all remembering the passing of Prince just about 7 years ago this week. And the man that we're going to be talking about in the book that you wrote, Deeper Blues, The Life, Songs, and Salvation of Cornbread Harris, just celebrated his 97th birthday.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, and he hasn't changed. I met him years ago. We'll talk more about it when he was playing at Nikki's Cafe downtown in what's now called the North Loop. But I remember when you and I were talking a few years back, you told me about this project. So enlighten my listeners to know, when did this project, this great book about the legendary Cornbread Harris, come about?
Well, I realized in hindsight that Cornbread and his son, Jimmy Jam, the producer, as you know, who has, you know, made worldwide fame with his partner, Terry Lewis, as a producer, they both kind of came into my life around the same time. I met Cornbread in 2017. He came into Minnesota Public Radio to do a session with me, and it became instantly my favorite in-studio session that I'd ever recorded with an artist. He is an incredibly charismatic man, just charmed the pants off of me and my co-host at the time. And we were, you know, both just remarking, like, wow, what an incredible, not only musician, but storyteller and personality and just a wonderful human being to be around. So he immediately captured my attention. But it wasn't until a few years later, in 2021, when I got a text out of the blue from Jimmy Jam, who I had gotten to know a little bit by then. And he said, hey, sorry to bother you, but do you happen to know how to get a hold of my father?
Wow.
And I knew that they had been estranged, but I didn't really know any of the details or how long or anything like that. And, I mean, what a text to get out of the blue from someone like Jimmy. And I said, yes, I do. And I put him in touch with people that I knew could help line up a meeting between the two of them, and didn't really know what was going to happen next. And then a few days later, I got another text from Jimmy, and it was a picture of Cornbread and Jimmy's son, Max, who was at that time 21 years old. And Jimmy said, you know, we just got to see Cornbread. It was the first time Max had ever met his grandfather, and it was the first time that Cornbread and I had talked in about 35 years, which was just jaw-dropping, and I just set the phone down and burst into tears at that point because, you know, I mean, what a moment, and to, you know, have him share it with me was so, so moving and incredible that without really even thinking anything through any further, I said, I have to write about this. It's more than, you know, an article, clearly. There's a huge story here, And I paid Cornbread a visit within days of getting that text and said, hey, I think I need to write a book about you, and I hope you're along for the ride with me. And he was very supportive and very flattered, and we've been meeting regularly ever since. That was about 3 years ago now.
Well, what a wonderful way to spend some afternoons for the last several years, Andrea Swenson. I have to ask you, we're both Northern Minnesota folks. I came from Virginia, Minnesota, the Iron Range, and you were a Moose Lake native. Now,
that's right.
When I was growing up, there was very, you know, literally there was one black person in town. His name was James White, and of course they called him Whitey. He worked for my grandfather. He was a handyman. He was a very beloved character, but there wasn't hardly any black music that I was could access or listen to live. So, of course, I got all of my first tastes of black music through television, whether it was B.B. King, the Staple Singers, Stevie Wonder, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Jimi Hendrix, and all the rest. And I fell in love with it, and I knew there was something in my soul that really responded to this music and this culture without being actually living around African Americans. And you growing up in Moose Lake, I know enough about it where it's predominantly white. How did you really get in touch with black music? You're one of the Prince experts, not only in the Twin Cities, but perhaps in the country. But how did a white gal from Moose Lake become so enamored and write so well and produce shows so well, highlighting the great music that came out of the north side of Minneapolis?
I love this question. It's something I think about a lot. You know, like, as you mentioned, Moose Lake, almost exclusively a white community. As you, I was introduced to black music through television. For my generation, it was Prince and Michael Jackson, of course, and you know, all of the stars that were breaking the color barrier on MTV in the 80s, and I was very captivated by all of that. And really, it was, I believe, in the live music scene that really opened a lot of doors in my mind of being exposed to other perspectives and people of other backgrounds. And then, you know, coming up in the scene in the Twin Cities, I got to a point where I had been working around local music for about a decade, and I just kind of had this epiphany at one point of, you know, we like to talk about how we're such a progressive state and that we've come so far in terms of equality and building a really equitable, you know, scene and place to live, but the reality is that we're still facing huge segregation issues, disparity issues for people of color all throughout Minnesota, including in the Twin Cities. And it got me thinking about, you know, why is it that there's so many bands that will play in Minneapolis and you go and you see almost exclusively white people, and then there's other artists that will play and it'll be almost exclusively an audience of people of color, and why is it still so separate? So that got kind of my wheels turning about just trying to understand it. And I think because I am just a curious person, it got me, you know, questioning the history of this place and how we got to where we are today. And I talked to a lot of musicians, and all of my knowledge is informed by, you know, first-person interviews with people who have been gracious enough to speak with me. So, you know, as you mentioned, my first book got to be something here. I spent years talking to artists who, you know, specifically black artists who were at the time in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, who had, you know, come up in the mainly 60s and 70s decades, and, you know, could tell me about the realities that they faced as black artists trying to play music and the intense color barrier that existed and in some cases still exists in Minnesota. So I think for me, it started as a curiosity and an attempt to understand this place that I care about so deeply, and it led to getting to know these incredibly talented artists who just happen to be black, and learning more about their culture and their history has become a huge passion of mine. And then the other thing is just, you know, when it comes time for me to do something like a book where I'm going to spend a lot of time with it, I'm really interested in elevating stories that haven't been told, and this is a community that has been just hugely underrepresented when it comes to books and documentaries and, you know, kind of substantial storytelling in Minnesota.
And, you know, what I loved about, there's got to be something here, you gave such nice, warm accolades to my partner for 10 years and one of the dearest human beings I ever met, Mr. Willie Walker.
Yes. Oh, I have such fond memories of both interviewing him, and then he was so gracious to come and play at my book release show at the Fitzgerald Theater, and I'll just never forget that set that he gave. He had just gotten off of a cruise. He was on a blues cruise, like a cruise ship, and he, I believe, had landed at the airport at something like 6 p.m. that day, and he was supposed to go on at 8:30, and he walks in the back door, and the sound tech goes up to him and says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Walker, there's not going to be enough time for you to do a sound check," and he looks at him and says, "Sound check? Just make sure the microphone's on."
Oh,
and he just strolled right out and absolutely enchanted the whole room. It was really, really wonderful.
Really one of the greatest, last of the great living soul singers, Mr. Willie Walker. May he rest in peace. Boy, I miss that guy. We're going to listen to a young Cornbread Harris back when he was with Augie Garcia. We've got Andrea Swenson on for the whole show tonight. We're going to listen to a song that was on the B-side of Hi Ho Silver, a big hit for Augie Garcia. Talk about Augie and a young Cornbread with Andrea for the whole show tonight. So here we go. Let's rip it up. This is called Going to Chicago.
Chicken and cornbread, pig feet and cornbread, dandelions and cornbread, pork chops and cornbread, monkey hips and cornbread, baby cornbread, say cornbread, cornbread, I love a good cornbread. Inspectors like cornbread, nurses like cornbread. cornbread. Scientists like cornbread.
Welcome back to the Wall of Power Radio Hour. That was the great Cornbread Harris singing with Augie Garcia. The Cornbread Song. We've got Andrea Swenson, who wrote a great book called Deeper Blues, The Life, Songs, and Salvation of Cornbread Harris. Andrea, that is just a great example of a guy's humanity, and Cornbread has such a great sense of humor.
Yes, he does. Yeah, that is kind of his signature anthem right there. It's how he got his name, Cornbread. And the fascinating thing about that song is that both he and I had assumed that the song came about a little bit more recently, maybe in the 80s or 90s when he was playing at Nikki's Cafe a lot, as you mentioned.
Right.
But I actually found a newspaper clipping that mentioned Jim Harris, which is his real name, and then in parentheses, Cornbread, from 1963. So he had been playing it for at least, you know, 50, 60 years at that point, which was really, really incredible.
So did he pick up the nickname Cornbread from that song?
Yep, yeah, it became kind of a calling card for him, and people would request it, and then they just started calling him Cornbread.
Well, it works, right? Well, tell the people out there in the Wall of Power Radio land about Augie Garcia, one of the first real rock and rollers from the Twin Cities, from West St. Paul, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, this was such a fun thing to learn about. There's a whole chapter in my book about Cornbread meeting Augie and joining his band. Cornbread was working down at a plant called American Hoist and Derrick, and he remembered being off work one day waiting for the bus, and he dipped into a bar down there on the west side of the river in St. Paul, and he met Augie, and they got, you know, along immediately. They started talking about how they were both musicians. And Augie mentioned that he had just started this residency down at the River Oak Club, and he wondered if Cornbread would like to come in and sit in on piano. And, of course, at that time he wasn't known as Cornbread yet. He was known as Jimmy Harris.
Right.
And he said, sure, you know, I'll come check it out and dust off the piano and we'll start playing. And it became a huge, huge hit. Augie had come up in the scene playing more traditional Mexican folk music. He was a Mexican-American gentleman, and he switched to rock and roll as it was becoming kind of a fad in the, you know, mid-50s, and they together created this really unique sound that combined Augie's roots with Cornbread's roots, which were more influenced by, you know, R&B and blues music at that point, and they came up with this kind of shuffling rock and roll sound, and it totally took the local scene by storm. They would play four nights a week at the River Oak Club, and it would be standing room only, all these teenagers packed in, dancing. And they even got written up in the Star Tribune back then, which was a kind of a rarity if you were a local band, especially a local band playing rock and roll music. And of course, I know you know this story, their claim to fame is that they got to open for Elvis Presley when
That's
he came
right.
down in 1956, and they were so beloved by the local teenagers that Colonel Parker yanked them off the stage because he didn't want them upstaging the headliner that evening. So Augie and Cornbread both wore that as a huge badge of honor for the rest of their musical careers and would brag about it anytime you ask them about it.
As well they should. Now, tell the people out there what Augie's stage wear was.
Yeah, he would most commonly be seen in a pair of Bermuda shorts and a coat, a suit jacket over it. It was a very unique look for him. And the one thing that I thought was kind of interesting, too, is Cornbread had mentioned that Augie used to work for the power company, so he was really comfortable climbing up poles and stringing power lines, and it made him a fearless performer. So he would hop up on the rail and hop up onto Cornbread's piano and dance around and do this kind of like tightrope walk up and down the bar, and he just would mesmerize the audience, and it was because he was so used to climbing up on telephone poles.
Well, there's a great picture of that in your book, Deeper Blues and Life Songs and Salvation of Cornbread Harris. It was just wonderful. Now, I don't know if I ever told you this story. There was really, we've never talked about it, but there was a tragic car accident when some teenagers leaving the River Road Club. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, it kind of put a kibosh for a while on the whole idea of having these shows down at the River Oak Club, because it was a really unique spot, and it's actually a spot that no longer exists because they rerouted the river at that point, the Minnesota River. But it was a really set far down on a single-lane dirt road, so you had to drive for about a mile off the main road down in Mendota, Minnesota. And it was kind of extended out almost to like a peninsula where the club sat on the end of this thing. So it was a precarious driving situation to begin with, but then you add, you know, people going out and enjoying live music till 2 in the morning. And unfortunately, one night when it was winter time, a group of young women got in their car after the show and it slid right into the river, and almost all but one of the women died on the scene. And it really cast a pall over that club, and they stopped, you know, booking so many shows out there after that and kind of started moving around to other venues. But the interesting thing from a historic standpoint is that the people that came out after the accident to take pictures for, I believe, insurance purposes, snapped some shots of the outside of the River Oak Club, and that's the only known photograph of the club. And you can see it's just a tiny, nondescript little building that looks like a roadside tavern that you'd see in a small town. And it was really, you know, fascinating to go back and look at this picture and think about, you know, how much history was happening in this weird little spot on the side of the river in this tiny little building.
You know, I've got a weird aside. So there was a book that came out about, oh, I'm going to say 15, maybe 20 years ago. And it was all of the St. Paul Pioneer Press crime photos. And it had all different kinds of things, from when the Ham daughters got kidnapped, and John Dillinger, and different crime sites. But there was a picture of when they were getting those the car out of the river where you said those women died, and there was one survivor. I had the book over at my house, and my buddy Sonny Earl was over, who I've been playing with. We just celebrated 25 years of playing blues and our own music together. And I lent him the book, and he had a friend whose mother was the surviving woman in that accident. And the story she told him, that he told Sonny, and Sonny told me, when she came to, and it was freezing, the river was freezing, it was the middle of the winter, she came up, and Augie was there, because they had left right after the gig, and Augie was in his shorts, and he had a red cape on, and when this woman came to, she looked up, she saw Augie, she thought she had died and gone to hell, and she thought Augie was the devil.
Oh, wow. That is wild.
Isn't that a crazy story?
Wow. What a moment.
Oh, yeah. So then Cornbread played over the years, and because we only have a certain amount of time, and, you know, Cornbread's had over an 80-year, 85-year history of playing music around town. I got to know him when he was playing at Nikki's Cafe downtown, and which was not too far, right off Washington Avenue. And he was just a great guy. He was such a great entertainer, such a great guy to listen to, great place to take your friends when they were in town. And I played at Nikki's for, oh, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. And I don't know if Cornbread ever told you about Nikki, but she had a big, wild, bushy hair, and she'd sit at the bar towards the end of the night with her purse and her little notebook, writing notes, drinking a big glass of scotch. And I was playing there one Sunday night, and it was really slow. It was about 11:30. My buddy Bobby Vandell, who played with a lot of these musicians, came in from Los Angeles. And he said, when are you going to play till? I said, midnight. He goes, come on, there's nobody here. Let's go down to Bunkers and hear Mambo's Cabo. So we took off, thought I could cut out early. Sure enough, right after I left, Nikki came in. And that was Paul Metz's last weekly gig at Nikki's. But that's really where a lot of people got to know Cornbread. He held that.
Yes.
How long did he play at Nikki's?
He played there for at least 7 years consistently, and then off and on until it closed in the early 2000s.
And the thing about seeing the cornbread down there, he let me sit in with him. He had, you know, J.D. Steele would come in and sit in with him. And you never know who's going to show up. Of course, Metro Studio was right across the street. So a lot of musicians that were in town from out of town recording, or even in town musicians, they'd either go be hanging, listening to cornbread, or get up and sing with them. It was just such a delightful thing. We're going to listen to one more song here before we end the second set with my guest, Andrea Swenson. And, you know, most people that are aware of music in Minneapolis know Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, probably two of the most successful songwriting and producing duos in the world. I think they've got over 40 number one hits to their name, worked with Janet Jackson and boy, you name it. And but part of what I thought was really interesting, Andrea, when you were telling me about putting this book together, was how Jimmy Jam reached out to you and finally got a hold of his dad after 35 years. What a great, I mean, that's almost like that's sent from God, those types of connections. It's beyond a book. It's beyond anything you were able to do in the radio, as much great work you've done on your Prince podcast. I mean, this is like, this is literally, you were doing God's work, Andrea.
It definitely felt like some kind of calling in the moment, and it went on and on. I mean, once we started working on the book, you know, I texted Jimmy again and said, "Hey, it's me. I want you to know I'm starting this project with your father, and we would love to have you involved if you'd like to be involved." And at that point, there was no, it wasn't known if they were going to continue having any kind of relationship. You know, he had made this one visit, and they had apologized to each other and made amends, and that was kind of it. So as time went on, it became clear that they both wanted to be in contact with each other, but for whatever reason, I had to kind of act as the intermediary to make sure that it happened. And so I started interviewing them, you know, separately. I actually flew to L.A. and met with Jimmy at his studio that he owns with Terry Lewis, and that was a really incredible, you know, interview. And then I brought all of what he said back to Cornbread, and then that brought a lot of memories to the surface. And then pretty soon the three of us started jumping on Zoom together. You know, I would set up an iPad in front of Cornbread at his house, and we've continued doing that now for almost 3 years. Every week or two, we hop on Zoom and they catch up and they talk about music, and Jimmy fills his dad in on what he's been doing. And it's just honestly like the honor of a lifetime to have the front row seat to watching these two gentlemen rebuild their relationship. It's just been such a beautiful and human experience, and I just can't even believe that I'm in any kind of position to, you know, help them in this way, but it's just been so, so lovely.
Andrea Swenson, we're going to send you to Israel and see what you can do. Fix that situation. We're going to listen to a song Cornbread wrote for his son called Lesson, and then we'll be back with one more set with Andrea Swenson on the Wall of Power Radio Hour.
You think he's wrong. Diplomacy is something grand. You may sing a different song. There's no tit for tat. There's no time for that. We should have some fun. Then the right has won. This is a lesson. Do everything you can, building up the spirit in yourself to help your fellow man. There's no tit for tat. There's no room for that. To come to quite a few.
Welcome back to the Wall of Power Radio Hour. This is your host, Paul Metza. Once again, a shout out to my friend, the Divas, who created that beautiful little bumper music for me several years ago. Andrea Swenson, you've got a five-year-old and a little baby that's under a year old. How did you find the time raising daughters to write a book with everything else you do?
Well, you know, books, as you know, Paul, are a labor of love, and you just kind of fit it in around whatever else you're doing at the time. My first book I wrote while I was working, you know, very full-time active job at The Current, and this time around it was, you know, just finding those times after bedtime and, you know, when my daughter was at preschool at the time, that I could go visit Cornbread and do some research at the various libraries, you know, digging into his career. And I think when you're passionate about something, it just kind of takes a hold of you, and you just figure out how you're going to make it work.
Well, and this truly is, you know, because we've gotten to know each other over the last many years, and you know, so I followed this whole project with you and your relationship, what I knew from afar, with Cornbread. And I know how much, once you got into it, it seemed like the more time you spent with Cornbread, the more you loved him.
Oh, absolutely. And the more I learned. That's the interesting thing about hanging out with someone who's in their mid-90s is that, you know, you might ask him something one week and he doesn't remember anything about it, but then you mention the same thing the next week and all of a sudden this fully formed memory will just pop out. So there was something really fascinating and rewarding about this repeat visit, you know, that we had every Tuesday at the same time. We would kind of go through the same routine. I would always call him and he would always say the same things as I was, you know, good morning, good morning. He always answers his phone and I'd tell him I'm coming over and we'd do our little routine getting into the house and settling in, and then we'd just kind of see what happened, see, you know, where his mind was at that day and what was going to come up, and it became this really, really wonderful, just kind of repetitive thing, just, you know, just to kind of dig around and see where we could lead the conversation and see what might be jogged by whatever music or newspaper clipping or conversation with Jimmy we were going to have that day.
Well, he must be completely enthused and excited that finally, at the age of 90 freaking 7 years old, he's got a book out, and you're talking about putting out a some sort of musical component to it, correct?
That's right, yeah. So the book is, you know, just a thrill in its own right, because he and I have been working on this for so long now. He got to hold the preview copy in his hands the other night, and that was really, really special to finally, you know, have a physical, you know, evidence that this is leading to a book. I read the whole book aloud to him as I was writing it, so he knows, you know, every word. He's heard everything that I had to say, and that was a really beautiful process. But then to feel the physical book was quite a moment. And then, you know, I got so many questions when I put out my first book about all of these, you know, kind of pioneering R&B artists, but people wish that there was some way to listen to the music as you're reading. So it inspired me to dig into Cornbread's catalog and put together an anthology that spans his entire career. Well, actually, not entire career, because he's still going strong.
Right.
But the music on the anthology record starts in 1955 with that Augie Garcia recording and ends in 2021 with a record that he made with the Peterson Brothers here in town.
Wow.
So it's incredible that it's 66 years of music and it's not even his full career.
Andrea Swenson, I've got to ask you, I wanted to, because, you know, we lost Prince 7 years ago this month, and I thought, we got to talk about Cornbread because there's so much to talk about. I want to have you on soon just to talk about your love of Prince, but before we get back to Cornbread, I have to ask you one question. What's your favorite Prince song?
Oh, that's such a hard question because it changes all the time, but I think the one that just always moves me, it's probably a tie between How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore and The Beautiful Ones. I really love his torch ballads.
Oh, man. So, you know, God bless North Minneapolis. I mean, I remember Willie Walker telling me how he used to play, I forget what the name of the club, it was like America Spelled Backwards or something.
Oh, yeah, the Nakarima.
Yeah, right. And he used to have a little jam session. There was a young little black guy, skinny little black guy, that came up, and Willie would let him sit in and play, and that was Prince Rogers Nelson.
That's right.
So it's phenomenal when you look at what a stalwart Cornbread Harris has been, and Willie Walker, and the rest of those that held forth and raising just incredible generations of other musicians. We're going to listen to a song called Put the World Back Together. I want to hear the whole thing, but we've got about another minute left, Andrea, before we play this. I don't think we can say enough what a great humanitarian spirit Cornbread Harris has. Can you speak to that a little bit before we listen to his original song, Put the World Back Together?
Absolutely. He is a deeply spiritual man, and that informs a lot of his actions in the world. And he's been very involved in the North Minneapolis community, offering music lessons and education and community service to that area for decades now. His hallway is lined with different awards that he's received in recognition of that role that he's played in the community. And that's something I really wanted people to understand with this book, and that's why it was important to me to include so many of the lyrics of the original songs that he's written. He really has a beautiful outlook on the world, and he's written so many great original songs that are poetic in their own way. So I hope that people are motivated to learn more about his songwriting and the message that he has to tell the world.
Andrea Swenson, what is your website?
It's AndreaSwenson.com. Nice and easy.
And that is Swenson with two S's at the end.
Yes.
And
buy
her books while you're talking with a Finlander here. So I dig it. This has been so incredible, Andrea Swenson. What's your Twitter handle as well? So many people are checking in via Twitter and X.
Oh, yeah. Slingshot Annie on all the different platforms.
Yeah. Well, this has been so incredible. Andrea, best of luck. I hope to see you soon. And if you ever get up to Duluth, if you don't stand Moose Lake too long, come and say hi. And congratulations on a great book. Give Cornbread my love. Ask him about the song Ghost Ship. He played it one night at Nicky's. It's one of my favorite songs, a very obscure tune. Tell them to break that one out again. But thank you so much, and good luck with the book. I hope you sell a million copies.
Oh, thank you so much, Paul. Your support means the world to me. I really appreciate it.
Have a beautiful rest of your weekend, and hug your daughters for me.
I will. Thank you so much.
Haven't we had enough debate? Did I hear someone say, let's wait? Why don't we get together before it's too late? Put the world back together. Put the world back together. Put the world back together again. Right in the country sounds insane. Smell your polluted water. Feel your acid rain. Cut down your forest, why don't you plant them back again? I said, put the world back together. Put the world back together. Put the world back together again. Politicians are talking fear and hate. Heard someone say, let's have a war. Blow them all away. That's stupid. Can't you hear me when I say, put the world back together. put the world back together. Put the world back together. The world back together. Put the world back together again. Back together again.
Wall of Power Radio Hour. We are grooving out to a song called Blue, 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 Blue by the great Cornbread Harris. This show was produced by Paul Metza, engineered by Brett Johnson. We'd like to thank our guest, Andrea Swenson. Her website is andreaswenson.com, S-W-E-N-S-S-O-N. She's got a book release coming up on August 16th at the Cedar Theater on the West Bank. And it will feature the great Cornbread Harris and his son, legendary producer Jimmy Jam. You can follow me at paulmetza.com. We're going to be celebrating the 10th year of the Wall of Power Radio Hour here soon. As soon as we get it figured out. But hey, we're in no hurry here in the Wall of Power Radio Hour land. We want to wish Cornbread Harris a very happy 97th birthday year. He's one of the sweetest guys you've ever met and just a phenomenal musician. Truly legendary cat. Go see him any chance you can get. Spring's right around the corner. We got some great shows coming up. And I want to thank everybody for listening. I'll be down there in the Twin Cities playing one of these days. But if you get up to Duluth, I'm at the Blackwater Lounge every Wednesday night, 231 East Superior Street from 6 to 8. And like my dad used to tell me, remember to be kind and make someone happy.